The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This morning I thought I'd talk about the Eightfold Path within the context of the Four Noble Truths. So this isn't going to be quite the standard Eightfold Path talk. So first I'm going to kind of lay out the overview of the Four Noble Truths and look at different ways that the Eightfold Path can be understood within that context. So the usual way that the Four Noble Truths are understood is actually inherent within the way that they're stated. The first noble truth being the truth of suffering, the second being the truth of the cause of suffering, the third being the truth of cessation of suffering, and the fourth being the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, which is the Eightfold Path. And the way in which this is laid out gives us a kind of a cause-effect model for how we understand things. That the first, there's the suffering, and then the second is the cause. So the first truth is the effect, and the second is the cause. And the third truth is the cessation of suffering, which is the effect, and the fourth truth being the path leading to the cessation of suffering is the cause, which leads to the effect of the cessation of suffering. So it is kind of an understanding of cause and effect in the way that the Four Noble Truths are usually laid out. And in this model, the path leading to the cessation of suffering is understood as what we cultivate, what we do in our practice. Just so that we're not... Just to make sure everybody is on the same page with this, I'm going to just briefly go through the components of the Eightfold Path so that we all have the understanding of what we're talking about with respect to the Eightfold Path. Actually, first, I think I'll go through a little bit of the Four Noble Truths. So the truth of suffering, the truth of dukkha, is basically the understanding that there is this quality of reactivity, of suffering that results from greed, aversion, and delusion. That the suffering that's meant in this First Noble Truth isn't about physical pain, it's about reactivity to both physical and mental experience, both painful and pleasant. So we may react to pleasant experience by being afraid to lose it, or by feeling sad when it disappears. We may react to neutral experience by just spacing out around it, by not connecting with it, by feeling it's not important or not worth our while. So we can have this kind of reactivity out of greed, aversion, and delusion, which is essentially what leads to our suffering, coming out of any kind of physical and mental experience. But it's not the physical and mental experience itself that is the suffering, it's the reaction that is the dukkha, the suffering. The effect, the cause or the origin of that is understood to be wanting or craving. And this is, looking at how our minds are structured. When we experience something pleasant, we like it, we want it. So that's that kind of reactivity off of pleasant. When we experience something unpleasant, we don't like it, we want to get rid of it. That's the reactivity off of unpleasant. When we experience something neutral, we often just don't connect, or if we do, we're bored, we space out around it, we misunderstand it. That's the reactivity off of neutral. So the cause of suffering isn't the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience. It's this propulsion out from the experience through one of these avenues of greed, aversion, or delusion. And that movement, the impulse for that movement is wanting, is craving. It's either wanting something that's pleasant or wanting to get rid of something that's unpleasant. So that's the second noble truth, the cause of suffering. The third noble truth, the cessation of suffering, is about the possibility for there to be an ending of suffering. And often, in fact, this standard model of the Four Noble Truths is kind of understood in a medical model, that the Buddha, at being kind of the physician of the human condition, he states the illness that he sees, which is the suffering, and the cause of the illness, which is the craving. And then the prognosis. What's the prognosis for this? Well, it's possible. It is possible to end suffering. So the prognosis is very good, excellent, in fact, if we follow the prescription, which is the Eightfold Path. So that's kind of, how this is laid out. And so the Eightfold Path, is basically this set of practices we engage in. So it's the prescription. It's the medicine the Buddha offers us to cure our ills of suffering. And the practices begin with wisdom, begin with understanding kind of the model of how our suffering is created in the first place. So the wisdom aspect of the Eightfold Path comprises the aspects of wise view and wise intention. The kind of most basic definition of wise view is understanding what is skillful and what is unskillful with respect to what leads us towards suffering and away from suffering. So what's skillful in terms of what leads us away from suffering? What's unskillful is what leads us towards suffering. So that's the kind of basic understanding. What is unskillful behavior? What is skillful behavior? And the basic understanding here is that unskillful behavior is behavior based in greed, aversion, and delusion. Skillful behavior is behavior based in non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. Actually stated in the negative. There are other definitions of wise view. The understanding of cause and effect. Basically the understanding, essentially, part of the understanding of what's skillful and unskillful includes this understanding of cause and effect. That when we behave in ways that lead towards skillful outcome, we are engaging in the cause for that skillful outcome. So the understanding that our actions have consequences is part of this wise view. And the basic definition of wise view is an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And again, this comes back to cause and effect. Craving leads to suffering. This path of the Eightfold Path are the skillful actions we can engage in that lead to the end of suffering. So it points out, even in the stating of the Four Noble Truths, there's the unskillful cause of craving is kind of the root cause of the result of suffering. And the activities of the Eightfold Path are the skillful actions and mental qualities that lead us out of suffering. So this is wise view. And wise view, at the beginning, we need to understand it as kind of an intellectual thing. We need to just kind of understand the model. And then we can reflect on the model. Does it make sense? We begin to test it in our experience, and we begin to see it does make sense. You know, when I act this way, it results in these experiences. When I act in this way, it results in these experiences. So that we, using this wise understanding, we begin to see how we begin to validate it through our own experience. But at the beginning, it really is taking in the information, reflecting on it before we start to act. The beginning to act is the second aspect of the Eightfold Path, wise intention, which is action is formed out of intention. We don't act without intention, and so the intentions that will lead to skillful actions are wise intentions. And these are intentions that are formed out of understanding what's skillful and unskillful. So with these understandings, then we start to actually take these intentions and this understanding and move it into our activities. And this is the second aspect of the Eightfold Path, the aspect of ethical conduct, or sila, the Pali term sila. And this is wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. So this is the outward manifestation or the outward behavior that results from the decision to act from a place of wise intention. Wise speech. And all of these areas of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood are stated in the negative as things to avoid. So with wise speech, avoiding false speech, avoiding harsh speech, avoiding divisive speech, avoiding idle speech. Wise action, avoiding taking life, avoiding taking what is not given, avoiding activities that with our sexuality that can cause harm, sexual misconduct. So essentially these areas of wise speech and wise action are about non-harming. They're about finding ways to live harmoniously. It's crucial in this exploration of wise speech and wise action to have it imbued with wise intention, with the intention towards non-harming, the intention towards moving away from suffering, both towards suffering of ourselves and suffering of others, that we consider the entire world in terms of how our actions can create suffering, and not just ourselves. So that the movement in wise speech and wise action is cultivating these skillful intentions, is really based in these skillful intentions. It's possible to engage in refraining from lying, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from divisive speech, out of an intention of a gaining intention, you know, a purpose to want to gain power or gain control or gain respect. It's possible to engage in these out of an intention of deception even. So that's not what is meant by wise speech. It's not just the action. It's the intention that imbues the action. And wise livelihood is essentially, wise livelihood is livelihood that does not compromise wise speech and wise action. Plus, the Buddha added some additional livelihoods that should be avoided, which do not explicitly violate wise speech and wise action, but essentially move in that direction. And these are the avoiding certain trades, avoiding trading in living beings, avoiding trading in poisons, in weapons, in intoxicants. What's the last? Oh, and in meat. So all of these things are essentially, avoiding trade in things that generally cause harm. You're not actively causing the harm in doing the trade, so it's not violating. You're not actively taking life or actively taking what's not given in selling somebody poison or selling somebody another human being, participating in slave trade or in selling somebody an animal for slaughter. But you are heading, it's heading in that direction. And so that's why the Buddha explicitly included these. It's not that you can engage in wise livelihood in which there is false speech. You know, being a lawyer where I have to lie or something, you know, in it, is not stated as one of the five occupations to avoid. The instructions are clear. In all of our behaviors, we need to avoid of unwise speech and unwise action. So living our lives in harmony is basically what this aspect of the Eightfold Path, what this training is about. And we actually cultivate these qualities. We engage in the intention to behave in this way. We will make mistakes. We'll find ourselves out of kilter and finding ourselves lying at times or taking what's not given in small ways and then realizing, oh, okay, I've made a mistake. This isn't about beating ourselves up for the mistakes, but it's more about learning, reflecting on what happened there. You know, what was the situation that led me into that activity? Learning from it and possibly making a redress if it's appropriate. So as we... Yeah?
So is the intention not to suffer could be thought of as a selfish intention?
It can be, you know, this is where we get into kind of the gray area around wanting. And, you know, often in, at least in the West, in the way we talk about this, it's talked about whether there's some skillful kinds of desires, which is the desire to lead that leads us to the end of suffering can be a skillful kind of desire. There can be a way that we hold on to that with craving, and it can be unskillful. But the way I look at it for myself is basically, is there suffering involved in the wish? If in that wish you're actually engaging in skillful actions that will support your letting go of suffering, that's a skillful wish. What I find for myself is that, you know, at certain points in practice, you know, a wish for a certain, I don't know quite how to say this, but there's a wish for a certain kind of freedom or a wish for, you know, letting go. And sometimes that wish for letting go actually feels painful itself. That's when we need to let go of that wish. So what has previously served us, at times on our path, it seems like we are served by certain desires for liberation, for letting go, for cultivating concentration, for cultivating mindfulness. We're served by those. And at some point in practice, there can be this place where we start seeing that those desires are actually in the way. And then we have to let them go. So there's kind of a skillful use of some desires initially on the path. And so it's a tricky place to navigate. We can't simply, at least in my understanding, we can't simply say, well, all desire is unskillful, and therefore I'm not going to do anything. Because in that, when we don't do anything, basically our habits take over, and our habits essentially pull us back into the realm of the unskillful. So initially we have to navigate this water with taking action, choosing to take action, which is in a sense a wanting, it is a desire. So it's a place that we have to explore each ourselves. We'll find that barrier at different times in our practice. So as we engage in the skillful conduct, we start to see how the mental climate of our minds supports the skillful conduct, that when we are more peaceful, we tend to behave more peacefully. And we also start to see that when we behave peacefully, it kind of rebounds on our minds. When we behave peacefully with the intention of cultivating peace, that has a rebound effect on our minds. So when we're motivated by wise intention, this practice of skillful behavior begins to reverberate in our minds. And this moves us into the area of mental cultivation, which is the third aspect of the Eightfold Path, comprising the last three elements of the Eightfold Path: wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And these both support the cultivation of the non-harming activity and result from the cultivation of the non-harming activity. And with that basis of non-harming as a ground, we can deepen into our mental life and really begin to understand and kind of destructure. It gets destructured as we begin to understand how do our habits work. So this aspect of the Eightfold Path is about looking at our minds, looking at how our habits come into being, how our minds react and respond to things. So it's really about learning about how our minds do what they do. We engage in wise effort through, again, this comes back to understanding skillful and unskillful. We actively avoid engaging in skillful mental states and let go of we avoid engaging in unskillful mental states and actively avoid see if we can let go of those unskillful mental states that have arisen. And we actively engage in cultivating wholesome states and try to maintain the ones that have arisen. Using mindfulness to help us in this guide. We really can't do this without mindfulness. That the mindfulness is what helps us to see and to understand what's happening to us. And as we engage with effort and mindfulness, concentration builds. And that concentration in turn supports a deepening of mindfulness, a kind of a sharpening of the knife of attention. Mindfulness is like the knife of attention, and the concentration is like the edge, the sharpening of the edge. That the more the concentration, the clearer the mind can really understand how it's put together and how suffering is created. This area is really where we see, in experience, not intellectually, the truth of cause and effect. We see that that the mind will move from pleasant to liking to wanting, and that wanting feeling just feels so it's a suffering feeling around that wanting. How it moves from unpleasant to not liking to not wanting, and how that's painful. So we actually understand in our present moment experience how these processes lead to suffering in the present moment. And in that understanding, in seeing that, essentially the mind begins to understand its own role. It really directly sees that the suffering isn't coming from out there and being imposed upon us. It's actually being created from inside our own minds. And when the mind actually recognizes that, it starts to let go. It starts to realize how it can let go of the ways that it contributes to its own suffering. So that's the kind of the short view or the short version of the Eightfold Path, not going into detail on each one. And again, you know, with the standard way of understanding the Four Noble Truths, these are practices. The Eightfold Path are our ways of engaging in walking the path. Now, when we look at the Four Noble Truths as a list, the Buddha created many lists. It's kind of an odd list. If we kind of look at the majority of lists that the Buddha created, they kind of start with, like for instance, the five faculties: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. Kind of, it's clear that you don't first develop faith, then you develop energy, and then you develop mindfulness, then you develop concentration, then you develop wisdom. But there is a directionality there. And the wisdom is the culmination of that. Likewise, the seven factors of awakening, the last quality, equanimity, is the culmination of the list. Many, many of the lists have this direction to them. And here we have a list where the last quality of the last thing in the list seems to be the first thing that we have to do. So it's a little bit odd. It's a little bit odd. So what might we learn by thinking about the Eightfold Path as being the culmination of the Four Noble Truths? Thinking of it more sequentially, in a way. And we can do this. It can really be understood that way in terms of how we engage moment to moment in the practice, in a sense. That the first noble truth, the Buddha indicated that what the activity that needs to happen around the first noble truth is that we need to understand it. So we need to understand suffering. And understanding suffering, when we really deeply understand suffering, we understand that we have to let go of craving. That actually what happens as we understand suffering, as we deeply understand suffering, the mind sees the craving and it actually lets go of it. So in a sense, the work to understanding suffering leads to the letting go of craving. And when we let go of craving, That's the letting go of craving is the action that the Buddha recommended around the second noble truth. So when the second noble truth is to let go of the craving. The third noble truth, the action around the third noble truth is to realize the cessation of craving. We realize the cessation of craving by letting go of craving. And now we come to the fourth noble truth, which says that the path is to be cultivated. And this is, this is again where it gets a little bit odd, but we can also look at this as in the process of having understood suffering, having let go of craving, having realized the cessation of craving, in that place, we are then living the Eightfold Path. That in a sense, the Eightfold Path is the result of letting go of craving. It's the manifestation of letting go of craving. And there is, in fact, a sutta that kind of describes this. That it, I forgot to bring it with me, but I can roughly paraphrase it. The Buddha says that when someone has certain qualities, he describes them as being completely free, completely liberated. And what are those qualities? The quality of wise understanding of one beyond training. The quality of wise intention of one beyond training. The quality of wise speech of one beyond training, of wise action of one beyond training, etc., through the Four Noble Truths, through the Eightfold Path, plus two more, which I can't remember the exact words, but there's something along the lines of wise seeing things as they are and wise liberation, the one beyond training. So essentially, this is a statement that when someone is fully awake, they are the Eightfold Path. The way they behave in the world is a reflection of this path. It's not a doing. It's a description of how they are. So, in a sense, we can understand the Eightfold Path as being not only the path that we walk to reach the goal, but in effect, it is the goal. That we live, that the living in this way is essentially the expression of freedom. I think this is a very beautiful way to think about the Eightfold Path. It's not something that we're just trudging along. It's actually we're modeling, in a way, the behavior of enlightened beings. And there's a sutta that I love. That isn't. It's an early sutta. It's by most scholars, they understand this to be one of the earliest suttas in the canon. This is the one I want to start with. And it is a very practical sutta. It's called the Atthakavagga, and it's in a collection of suttas called the Sutta Nipata. And it's very practical, and it's not got a lot of the standard doctrine. It doesn't talk about the Eightfold Path. It doesn't even mention the Four Noble Truths in this. But it talks about qualities. It talks about what is a person like when they're enlightened? What does a person have to do to get there? And so I'll read you just little bits of this. I find this very inspiring. Having what vision, being of what character, is one called peaceful? Tell me about the Supreme Person. So this is basically somebody is asking the Buddha to describe what is an enlightened being like? And he says, the Buddha responds, a person who is not angered, not frightened, not boastful, and not worrying, who gives wise advice, is not agitated, is careful in speech, a sage. A person who does not cling to the future nor sorrow over the past, who finds seclusion amidst sense contacts and is not led astray. A person who is retiring, not deceitful, not covetous, not selfish, not impudent, not arousing contempt, who does not engage in malicious speech. A person who does not relish pleasure, who is not conceited, who is mild and of ready wit, who is not credulous and not bored. A person who does not take on the training in hopes of material gain, who is unperturbed if he gets nothing, who is not obstructed by craving and greedy for flavors, a person who is even tempered, constantly mindful, who does not suppose that anyone in the world is his equal, better, or lesser, who is free of conceit, a person who is free of attachment, who knowing Dhamma is not attached, someone in whom craving is not found for either life or not life. This is someone I call peaceful. So no statements of, you know, grand mystical experiences, simply peaceful, not angry, not boastful, not conceited. And then in the sutta also he talks about how might one behave in order to train in this path. Shariputra asked the Buddha, what should be his manner of speech? What should be the range of his conduct? What should be the resolute one's precepts and religious practices? One must not steal, one must not lie. One should touch beings with goodwill, both the timid and the meddlesome. When one is conscious that one's mind is agitated, allay it with the thought it is part of darkness. Esteeming wisdom, delighted by what is morally good, conquer one's difficulties. One should be restrained with the eyes. One should not roam about. One should apply oneself to meditation. When being reprimanded, maintaining presence of mind, one should welcome it. One must destroy any unfriendliness one might have for partners in the holy life. One should not utter words that are unskillful and untimely. There are several suttas that offer this kind of thing. A few more. A person should not have covetous eyes, close his ears to ordinary chatter. He should not be greedy for flavors. He should not be given to oversleeping. Being zealous, he should be given to wakefulness. A monk should not be a boaster. He should not speak scheming words. He should not make a habit of impudence. He should not utter quarrelsome speech. He should not be moved to tell lies. He should not deliberately be treacherous. He should not despise others for their way of life. If contemplatives or ordinary people irritate him with their talkativeness, he should not respond harshly, for the peaceful do not retaliate. And this, I think, really points to, this last one really points to the training. To cultivate peace, behave peacefully. So I like this model of thinking about the Eightfold Path both being, not being something that we actually get past. I mean, it's the way we will be the way we live our lives, the way enlightened ones live their lives. The difference is that in the one who is fully let go of craving, who has no craving whatsoever, the Eightfold Path is a natural manifestation of their being. That's my understanding, that it's not something they're doing, it's just who they are. And in this way, we can really see the Eightfold Path as being the culmination, in a sense, of the Four Noble Truths. So, what do you think? What are thoughts? Any thoughts about this?
I think
it's great. Easier said than done. Yes, that's the trick, and but to me, it's also it adds a little bit of inspiration in a sense. You know, it's like the way that we engage in this path isn't just the beginner stuff. I mean, it's the model of awakening. So to me, that's inspiring, this modeling awakening in a sense. Yeah.
As we go on, more and more is revealed, especially if we have the willingness to go into the painfulness.
Yes.
And there's many layers to it. And one of the most challenging yogas is relationship,
mm-hmm.
family. And I'm getting deeper insights into my spontaneous nature, who I am. And sometimes when I reveal this amongst family, I don't think about it. It just comes out. And there's...
Do you mean your spontaneous, more wholesome nature or your...
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. More wholesome nature. And I don't have any hurtful intent in this nature. However, that nature is much of the time being critiqued by other family members. So the conflict I'm having is being myself. It feels like it's so repressing to tone that down. And it's really going to take... I'm having difficulty giving in to doing that.
So a couple of questions. One, in the critique that's coming back, are people expressing that they have been hurt by the spontaneous nature? Or are they expressing a discomfort with your change?
They're uncomfortable with my actions, my speech, and they're taking things personally when I address my own processes in certain areas. And by that, I don't mean to project that.
Yes, but they are projecting for you.
They're projecting.
Yeah.
So.
I
almost feel like what they want me to do is be a mannequin, battery operated, remote controlled robot for them. I've really been reflecting on it, and you know, there's just been some real, you know, a lot of stuff there. You know, there's anger, there's wanting to pull back, there's, you know, these different states of mind, you know, that are just, you know, so challenging to. Challenging for me.
Yeah, yeah, so you are dropping down to another layer, essentially. I mean, what's happening? Often in family dynamics, when one person changes, it really creates an uncomfortable situation. And there's a lot of pushback. You know, there's a lot of that. Go back to the way you were. I liked things, or at least I knew things the way they were before. Now I'm going into territory that's not known. I'm not familiar with this. I'm not comfortable with this. Go back to the way you were. So you'll get some of that pushback, and you can, I think. Now this is challenging. I mean, to you know, in getting that pushback, meeting that skillfully, you know, finding ways to acknowledge. Yeah, I see this is uncomfortable for you. No.
Not all this.
So, I don't know if that came through on the audio tape or not. So, you know, when you get that pushback, your initial response is one of anger. You know, so that you really need to watch out for. Yeah. That's where your next layer is. Now, not necessarily to try to stop that first layer, but now you're meeting a new layer. So watch that process of anger. That is not skillful, that anger, responding
like
to that.
Like last night I sat with it, and I just went right into it. And, you know, it wasn't comfortable. There was a lot of uncomfortableness. And, you know, these things, they take time.
They take time. Momentum.
You know, presto, it's gone. I looked at it 5 minutes, it's all, you know, no.
Yeah. So I think you've heard this analogy that I've given before, but I'm going to give it to you again just as a maybe an inspiration, as a little reminder. You know, when we've got these momentum of habits, like for you, anger is one of those. You get into that place, and it's got a strong momentum. So it's kind of like, you know, the car is going 100 miles an hour down the freeway. That's the momentum of that anger. And being mindful of it isn't like putting on the brakes. It's like putting that car into neutral. So put that car into neutral and just observe it. You know, you put the car into neutral, and it takes a long time to slow down if you're going 100 miles an hour. It doesn't just come to a stop. And the practice is to, in putting your mind into neutral through mindfulness, just watch the momentum without the agenda for it to stop. And that's where it's challenging. But it can help to have the interest in understanding this process of the anger. And that can help you to be with that momentum. So there's a kind of a trick, in effect, that we get familiar with, that putting the mind into neutral. It's like, you know, it's like disengaging the gears, but the gears are still spinning. So what is it like for those gears to be spinning? Can you just watch that? And, you know, as you do the process, probably the gears are going to engage again from time to time. And then when you notice that, it's like, oh, okay, can I disengage again? And that's partly why it can take so long, because the habits are to re-engage. The habits to re-engage with that process. So whenever you notice that, see if you can disengage, just watch. And patience. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, there's a...
Just a simple thought about what you're saying. Putting mind in neutral, one way of doing that is to simply say anger is happening.
Yes.
And when you... that, I think that does really help put the mind in neutral. The other thing, in the situation you're describing, it seems to me, when you can put your mind in neutral and say, you feel the feeling of anger, that's not ever going to stop. But when you say, oh, it's happening, it's what's happening in the moment, and then it frees you up to take in the bigger picture of the people, your interactions with the people you're interacting with. And sometimes then you can employ, for lack of a better word at the moment, compassion for their fear of... They're having fear because they're not understanding what the experience you're happening. If it's different, they may judge it and may react with anger or some adversity. But the compassion is what then frees you up to not have to take the anger you've just put in neutral and react. That's what I'm getting from what you're saying.
Yeah. And sometimes you can't call up that compassion. So patience with yourself around that.
Yeah, you have to contain it. Yeah, for a while, look at it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, sometimes the compassion isn't immediately obvious or present or able to be connected with. So don't, you know, there's no need to judge yourself if that's not immediately there.
I agree. I mean, first thing is, if anger is happening, not judge your own anger.
Yes.
And that may or may not help you be compassionate, but the non-judging.
Right. The non-judging is, yeah, and actually the non-judging is a compassionate action. You may not be able to feel it as such, but it is a compassionate action. Thank you. And Dick?
And also, just on that same point, I think an easier step than being compassionate toward the other person is being compassionate to yourself, because there's clearly pain right there. So,
yeah,
that was what I was going to say. You know, but I find that it's very helpful with family to alleviate the stress of the changes of, like, I'm going off to meditate now and stuff like that. Is the fruits of the path for them. In that, you know, I can be very present without an agenda and listen, you know, really listen with my heart to their heart and let their heart come forth and unwind with me as a vehicle. And this is very good for them. It makes them happy. So to let them enjoy the fruit of my practice.
And it may also, I mean, I'm just envisioning you know, two ways that might unfold. You know, if you're you know, kind of bludgeoning them with, well, look at all these good things you're getting. that's not gonna go over very well. But the actual being of that person is real. It's like being in a warm bath, and so not so much to be stating that, but to just be that person. And I think that's partly what I was saying in that moment of, you know, seeing that pushback. Can you meet that skillfully? You know, if you can be right there, oh, yeah, I see you're suffering right now. First, you do need to get past your own anger about the pushback. Yeah. In order to be in that place where you can really meet that. Yeah, because otherwise you may be, you know, modeling it without the right intention. This is an example of that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I heard recently some Ajahn Sushito said, you know, with the compassionate heart is actually drawn to pain.
Mm, it is. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And that is the most sustainable, much more sustainable than metta. Compassion is for the long range. That's where the real happiness is, because that's the sustainable.
That's an interesting
happiness.
Perspective. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that involves pain, other people's pain,
yeah,
your own pain,
yeah.
But you know, finding a joy in responding to that.
Thank you. Anyone else? I have just a minute or two. If there's any other comments? Okay, well, let's just sit for a minute then. And in this practice of sitting, see if you can just connect with where you are right now, that sense of, you know, just feeling the momentum of where you are right now and being in neutral around it. There may be bodily sensations. Just having the still container and allowing the natural settling of bodily experience and mental experience.